Buddhist Summer School, Sunday afternoon, 30th August 1981. The Buddha's affirmation of transcendence takes this form. Monks, there exists that condition wherein is neither earth, nor water, nor fire, nor air, wherein is neither the sphere of infinite space, nor of infinite consciousness, nor of nothingness, no thingness, you can pronounce it if you like, which will be more significant, nor of neither consciousness nor unconsciousness. Where there is neither this world, nor a world beyond, nor both together, nor moon and sun. Thence, monks, I declare, is no coming to birth. Thither is no going from life. Therein is no duration. Hence, thence is no falling. There is no arising. It is not something fixed. It moves not on. It is not based on anything. That indeed is the end of ill, of all dukkha. Now this statement is in relationship to the individual. And fundamentally, it implies that supreme meditative state, where there is, as ordinarily termed, the cessation of perception and feeling, the complete cessation. You must realize that when the word perception is used in connection with the deepest states of consciousness, that perception is something entirely different from what we mean by perception here in our ordinary everyday life. We perceive through the use of our senses. The sense activities make their impression on the brain, and the brain synthesizes all the impressions it receives into some sort of meaningful pattern. And when we form that meaningful pattern by using one of the extraordinary faculties that human beings possess, the faculty of speech, then we say that we perceive this, that, or the other. Then we can convey that perception to another through the use of language. That is our type of perception. But when one enters into the deeper states of consciousness, all sensory impressions go down. There is a cessation of sensory impressions. The brain becomes utterly quiet. And remember, the brain is the concretest part of mind. The physical brain itself is the concretest expression of mind. The brain becomes quiet and still, and you have entered into the real silence as such. Not merely the silence of speech, but the silence which is born of the complete quiescence of the sense functions. So perception, that perception too ceases in the supreme meditative state. And feeling, any sort of feeling whatsoever. By feeling, in the Buddhist context, it is one rarely means emotion, sentiment, or that sort of thing. It simply means, the word feeling simply means painful feeling, pleasurable feeling, or neutral feeling. So it's the perception of the functioning of the entire psychophysical organism, as far as its psychical functioning is concerned, and therefore it means that all the limitations imposed upon the deepest consciousness by our existentiality are completely removed, and one is really in the context of the eternal, the transcendent. So that's what he's talking about here. And that is indeed the end of ill. He goes on, hard is the infinite to see. Because we live in terms of finitude only here. Truth is no easy thing to see. Craving is pierced by him who knows. For him who seeth, naught remains. Now that doesn't mean that the universe disappears, or that his own physical existence disappears. Otherwise, there would have been no Siddhartha Gautama after he said this. It means that nothing which affects him in that state, which is due to all that aspect of manifestation which perishes, and in fact all manifestation does perish, and there is no awareness of it, no consciousness of it intruding upon that transcendent consciousness. And therefore he says, for him who seeth in that supreme sense, naught remains. In theistic terms, this has been put in the eyes of God. Now of course God has no eyes. If he had, he should have a body like ours and so forth, but we know that he hasn't. At least we think we know that he hasn't. At least I think he knows he hasn't. And therefore, the eyes of God are such that they do not see all that which interferes with his state of omniscience, the all-seeingness. Because that state of consciousness is the supreme state. Then the Buddha goes on, monks, there is a not born, a not become, a not made, a not compounded. Monks, if that unborn, not become, not made, not compounded were not, there would be apparent no escape. I would prefer to say no release from this here that is born, become, made, compounded. But since, monks, there is an unborn, not become, not made, not compounded, therefore the release from this here that is born, become, etc. is apparent. Now this is a statement of exceptional importance. And this statement is with reference to the whole cosmos. The first one was with reference to individual people. The second is with reference to the whole cosmos. And he ends up by saying, for him who clings, there is wavering. A this and that, a state of duality, and therefore a state of conflict. For him who clings not, there is no wavering. Wavering not being, there is calm. Samatha, the supreme samatha. Calm being, there is no bending, that is, inclining this way or that way due to our attachments and aversions. Bending not being, there is no coming and going. That means a birth and a death. Coming and going not being, there is no decease and rebirth. Decease and rebirth not being, there is no here or yonder, yonder meaning another world, nor anything between the two. This indeed is the end of ill. Now this affirmation of transcendence is one of the most remarkable affirmations regarding the unitary wholeness of the total cosmos. Now take this word unborn. This word occurs long before the time of the Buddha in the Rig Veda and also in the Atharva Veda. That means, if you take the Rig Veda, probably something like 1500 years before the birth of the Buddha, and the Atharva Veda at least 500 years before the birth of the Buddha. I have given here the Heart of Religion a complete list of references to the Atharva and the Rig Vedas, of references to the unborn. There's no point in just repeating figures, so we'll go on. Now, the Buddha says in those statements that the infinite is hard to see. If one is free from all craving, then it is possible to realize that state. And it is with respect to this Dhamma, as we saw yesterday, that he declared that it is deep, difficult to see, difficult to understand, but it is sweet, it is helpful, it is intelligible to the wise, and it is beyond all dialectic. That is very important, beyond all dialectic. Now, the formulation of these affirmations gives the impression of duality. We think in terms of this world and that world, the world here and the world beyond. The Buddha himself, in the Appanaka Sutta of the first volume of the Majjhima, but it comes in the translations into English, it comes in the second volume on page 71. The Buddha reiterates again and again, because there is a world beyond, referring of course to the state of consciousness in which the bhikkhu can enter, which is the world beyond, apart from this world, which is cognized by us through our senses and brain functioning. But there is that which is cognized beyond that, and that is the world beyond. It's a world, so we have again the idea of the two worlds, this, the perishable world, and that, the imperishable world, the material world and the spiritual world. Now this dualistic formulation in terms is unavoidable, because constituted as we are, we cannot avoid the language of duality. So we must necessarily, whenever we talk in terms of this and that. This which is the perishable, the dying, and that which is the imperishable. That which is the unborn and imperishable. But in spite of the fact that all our conceptualizing and verbalizing is in terms of duality, we do sense and are dimly aware of that which is other than this here, the finite, this here being the finite and the mortal. So we affirm a belief in transcendence and of a total, one total reality. Now, how is this so? How do we sense it? How is it that we come to be aware of it? In order to answer this question, we must first inquire in what manner are we conscious here and now. This is very important. our mode of awareness of existence as we are at present, here and now. How are we conscious? In the past, people talked in terms of a creator God as the source of the cosmos. Now, they had no option but to talk in those personalistic terms, because we being people, we tend to read ourselves into that which is greater than or beyond ourselves. Supposing we were lions, we would picture God as the super lion and say that he is the great lion, the king of everything that comes under his domain, and so forth and so forth. We talk in lion-like terms. We being human beings, we talk in human terms. So, we recognizing ourselves as persons, individual persons, present the idea of a creator God as a person, a father God, as the source of the cosmos. In our day and age, however, we may permit ourselves to talk in terms of the primordial, undifferentiated, creative energy, which is at the same time pure or absolute consciousness. Now you see, I have to talk using two terms, energy and consciousness. I have no option but to do that. But it is a unitary whole. It is a single unitary identity in a state of vibrant quiescence. Nothing's happening, apart from the fact that it is alive. It is this undifferentiated creative energy which is alive, an absolute or pure consciousness which does not function in the way we function when we are conscious of this, that or the other. There is no such thing as knowing in our sense of the term, knowing in the transcendent consciousness, nothing at all. It is an unknowing knowing. You know how mystics have talked of the cloud of unknowing. It is a state which you yourself can enter in the deepest meditative states. Now, this holds everything potentially. Now, one can suggest an analogy here in order to understand this. Supposing my name is John Peter Smith. Supposing that my friends, some of them call me John, some of them call me Peter. Well, if they say John, then I, the whole person, John Peter Smith, respond and say yes. Or if they call me Peter, I do the same. And you see, John, whether the word John is used or whether the word Peter is used, the whole unitary wholeness is there, responding. In that way, or something like that, there is this unitary wholeness of the primordial, undifferentiated creative energy and pure or absolute consciousness. Then there comes the point when there is a stir within the vibrant quiescence. There is movement. There is, so to say, it is already alive, but I don't know what else to say but to say a coming to life in manifestation. When this happens, the undifferentiated creative energy differentiates, and the primordial pure consciousness proliferates simultaneously with the differentiation of the energy. And therefore, grades and grades of being come into existence. Grades of being, not only in the physical sense, but in any and every sense, whatsoever there is, which composes the total reality of the cosmos as such. When these grades of being come into existence, they are always grades of what I like to call awareness being, hyphenated. The word being representing the formal manifestation, and the term awareness, the degree of awareness which is associated with that, standing for the differentiation of the pure or absolute consciousness. Vibrant quiescence changes to movement. The becoming process emerges. Each archetypal form has its specific function, and through each form, the whole of creative energy and the whole of consciousness works. Now, supposing I say to myself, it's something like this. Supposing I say, I wish to go to the village. Well, there is the wish present, the psychical aspect. Then I start walking to the village. The whole body goes, the whole of me goes to the village. And I'm conscious that I'm going to the village because I know the road, and therefore I can get to the village that way. I'm conscious of it. So you see, the whole of me is working through the different aspects as such. The different aspects don't work just separately and individually, unrelated to the whole of me. All the time, it's the whole of me functioning like that. And this is exactly what happens throughout the entire cosmos. The entire cosmos is perpetually working all the time through each and everything whatsoever and every person. We shall touch upon this tomorrow when we talk about karma and the real deep meaning of karma. So when I say I'm going to town, all these aspects are functioning through all these different aspects, my wish, my knowledge of the road, and my being conscious that I am walking towards the town, they are all operating simultaneously. Now, one archetypal form, when the differentiation process takes place, we may name pure mind. And another archetypal form, we may term matter. Primordial matter, which is the energetic source of matter as we experience it and understand it through our sense and brain functioning. Now, this primordial matter I call an archetypal form. What is this primordial matter? We have this similar ideas in the Sankhya philosophy. And in the Gita too, there are some statements which would bear it out. We have the terms Prakruti and Purusha. Prakruti is primordial matter, primordial nature, it is sometimes called. Now, what sort of thing is this? What has modern science to say on this matter? You know that the Big Bang theory is now predominant. Now, I want you to consider these figures a little bit. I'm sorry, I've forgotten the meaning of one term I'm going to use. My brain, unfortunately, is succumbing to the infirmities of age. The term is singularity. And the statement here is that 10 to the minus 43rd of a second after the singularity, which is the absolute starting point, this 10 to the minus 43rd second, what does it mean? It means 1 divided by 1 followed by 43 noughts of a second. Can you picture it? Can you at all, is there anything in our capacity which can capture that? And yet these are the results of modern scientific mathematical calculations by the mathematical physicists and so on. At 10 to the minus 43rd of a second after the singularity, and it is called the Planck time after Max Planck, the great scientist, all the matter we now see in the universe was compressed within a sphere of radius 1/1000th of a centimeter. All the matter that we now see in the universe was compressed within a sphere of radius 1/1000th of a centimeter. You know what a centimeter is. And a tenth of that is a millimeter. If our sight is not too good, we can just see 1 millimeter mark and the next millimeter mark. Divide that distance by 100 again and you'll get it. And it is the size of the point of a needle. That all the matter we now see in the universe was compressed into that point of the needle. At this moment, the observable universe was much smaller. Supposing now you and I, by some magic, were able to transport ourselves back to the beginning of the Big Bang, they say roughly 20 billion years ago. I haven't got any calendars to record that, but there we are, the mathematicians tell us that. At this moment, the observable universe, supposing we could transpose ourselves there. Now, although it was only the point of a needle, what we could see of that point of the needle, what we could examine it, imagine we are super astrophysicists there, you see, looking on. What we could observe was only 10 to the minus 33 of a centimeter in diameter. 1 divided by 1 with 33 noughts after it. That was all the observable universe then. And the density of that universe approached 10 to the power 90, 1 with 90 noughts after it, kilograms per cubic centimeter. Supposing that was, instead of being a point, it was 1 cubic centimeter, it would have weighed 1 with 10 noughts, with 90 noughts after it, kilograms. So you can imagine what an extraordinary thing could have happened. What sort of a thing was this primordial undifferentiated energy? What sort of a thing was this pure consciousness attached to it? You see, it's really inconceivable to us. It absolutely defeats imagination. However, this is what the scientists have to say, and they believe that they tell us the truth, and very often they do. So there we are. Now, so you can see that is what I call primordial matter. It is not material at all, as you can see. It's pure energy. Even the atom as we know it now, most people sort of conceive of the atom as a tiny, tiny particle. And a particle means something which you can hold between your fingers, and it will prick your fingers or whatever it is, you see. But it is nothing of the sort. It is pure energy as such. With respect to us human beings, none of us can speak in terms of my or your consciousness or mind. I mentioned that yesterday, you remember. Consciousness and mind are universals. The finite, mortal, existential being, you or I, cannot cut off a separate bit of the infinite, immortal, universal and appropriate it for himself. All archetypal forms function cosmically. Pure mind, the architect of the cosmos, is characterless. You have in the Zarathustrian teachings this represented as Geush Tasha, the architect of the universe. The architect, pure mind, is characterless. In order to understand this, you must meditate on the Buddha's phrase, Vijnanam Anidassanam Anantam Sabbato Pabam, or Paham. Which means Vijnana. You all know the word Vijnana, and it is roughly translated as consciousness. Strictly, it should always be translated as discriminative consciousness. Anidassanam, without any characteristics whatsoever. Anantam, endless, and therefore beginningless. Sabbato, everywhere. Pabam, shining. It's a very expressive phrase by the Buddha. Now this phrase is really the Buddha's phrase for the Upanishadic Atma. It is that type of consciousness. Perhaps the concretest involutionary stage in the becoming process is reached in the earthy condition. In minerals, consciousness is most imprisoned, laid to sleep. Thereafter, the evolutionary ascent begins. Life, structure, and function become more complex, refined, and sensitive. We see that in the process of development through the mineral, vegetable, the animal, and the human kingdoms as such. And in man, ego sense and self-consciousness definitely manifest. In relation to each of us human beings, this archetypal energy mind, I mentioned this yesterday too, you remember, interacting with body gives rise to psyche. It is rooted mainly in the activity of the brain and nervous system, the ductless glands, and the sense organs. Our thoughts and emotions, our perceptions and instinctive feelings, in short, what we commonly call our mental processes and life, constitute our psychical life. This is not mind, this is just the psyche at work, which is distinctive of each of us as an existential being. Thus we can say your psyche or my psyche with as much accuracy and legitimacy as we can say your ribs or my ribs, your hand or my hand, you see. Remembering always that this is so within the limits of the commonly agreed conventions of everyday speech. Each one of us as an existential being is a psychophysical organism, a particular apparatus through which the archetypal universals, mind and consciousness, function. But they are obstructed, the universals are obstructed by the imperfections of the apparatus, the psychophysical organism. My senses are like small apertures admitting only a fraction of the countless stimuli coming to me from outside. This is definitely known by physiologists. My brain and nervous system eliminate a good deal of these stimuli by a system of filtering and classifying devices as irrelevant buzz. And the relevant information is processed into manageable shape before it is presented to consciousness. My senses, therefore, convey the world to me not as a whole, as a universe, but as a collection of separate phenomena, objects, and creatures. Now, this is the very important point we must bear in mind. Thus, I am separatively conscious with respect to objects and isolatively conscious with respect to my fellow human beings. otherness dominates my consciousness as an existential being. There is me, the self, and everything else is the not-self. And you see why human beings are born remarkably conceited. I and the universe. Look at the disproportion. Self, not self. What can happen in our lives but conflict between each other and between ourselves and the world in which we live? So, my vijnana functions predominantly as discriminative consciousness. It is analytic, splitting up the wholeness of the one total reality. By contrast, pure consciousness is unifying, acting integratively. I use the word integratively very deliberately because synthesizing is more applicable in a mechanical sense. When you take things together and put them together, you say all the parts of a motor car, put all the parts together properly, you have synthesized the whole thing and you've got a mechanical instrument there at your command. But integration is a living process. Once a thing is integrated with something else, then these two have grown into each other. It's a living state. That's the difference. And with us and our evolutionary process, it's this integration which takes place. But the existential being, which is me, is the product of the self-limitation and self-constriction through many stages by the activity of the primordial creative energy, which is also absolute consciousness. We are actually, you and I as we are actually the descendants and heirs of transcendence itself. We are literally, even in our imperfect state, even in our ill state, our state of dukkha, the children of God, if we may use a theistic phrase. This is a literal fact. And our sorrow and difficulty and so on arises because we are ignorant of this fact. We are unaware of it, and we are certainly not intimately conscious of it. And therefore, because of the separation, because of the lack of right relationship between oneself, others, and the totality, there is dukkha all along the line. Hence, even in our unawakened state, though we largely live like blind children of mortality, we are dimly aware of the divinity embodied in this mortal vesture. Because that divinity is embodied through and through us, absolutely, through every single cell of our body. And it exercises a certain influence, subtly, of which we haven't awakened to that influence. That is our difficulty. Now we can see that because we are separatively conscious, all our psychical states and our languages and means of communication are subject to duality at least, and at times to multiplicity. Now that answers the question of in what manner we are conscious, you see, and it also answers the question which precedes it, namely, how is it that we are dimly aware, we dimly sense transcendence, because of the manner in which we have come into being in the universal process. Pure mind, yes, I have already said that. So we have these two essential archetypes, the pure mind and matter, And remember, this matter is not matter as we contact it. With respect to us human beings, our sense, none of us can speak in terms of my or your consciousness or mind. Consciousness and mind are universals, and the finite, mortal, existential being cannot cut off a separate bit, etc. I've already told you that, yes. Words like spirit and mind represent the very subtle manifestation of creative energy and pure consciousness. Matter and body represent the very concrete expression. So now we come to the two contexts which we must understand. The context, because we function dualistically, and we cannot escape that dualism until we are perfected holy ones, we have to consider the two contexts: the finite, temporal and mortal, and the infinite, eternal and immortal. Now I think this would be a useful point to place to stop and have a little rest, and we'll go on, and I'll answer some of the questions which have been asked me also. So those who wish to go to the 5:30 lectures which you would like to attend, could you please? Let us consider these two contexts which we can talk about. The context of the finite, the temporal and the mortal is the actual context in which we as persons live, living persons, you see. We are born, we grow up, we experience this, that and the other, and we die. All that is within the realm, within the sphere of mortality. And death's lord is master of it all, lord of it all. That is our ordinary context. This we come to know through the use of our senses and the brain. And of course helped by language. And we learn all this from those who are around us. First of all, our parents and friends and teachers and so on. So that is the context in, with which we are well acquainted. Then, because we are curious, we ask questions. Is there anything beyond this? What brought it all into being and so forth? And we postulate, arbitrarily postulate, but not necessarily mistakenly postulate, a transcendent and other something which the context of which negates our context. That is to say, our finiteness is negated by infinity. Our temporality is negated by eternity. Our mortality is negated by immortality. You see? So we have the two contexts. All our language, all our thinking process and so forth is restricted to the realm of the finite, the temporal and the mortal, because that is our experience. We can imagine, use our imagination with respect to the infinite, the eternal and the immortal. But one mustn't think that imagination is just sheer daydreaming and it is useless. It is helpful up to a point. But be very careful to differentiate between what imagination suggests and what you can actually see, realize, by becoming quiet and still. The silence is the most important aspect of religious living. And I think you will agree that although we live in this place for this week, this beautiful place which has marvelous opportunities of presenting silence to us, we negate silence when we are having our meals. completely negates silence. It's a terrible row. But there you are, you see. So let us consider this context of the infinite, the eternal, and the immortal, and its relationship to our context. Ordinarily, we use the word eternal to mean the endlessness of time. This is not the case. We treat it as the opposite of time. It is not the opposite of time. Time is completely subsumed within the eternal. There are those who equate timelessness with the eternal. This too is a mistake. Timelessness is subsumed in the eternal. The eternal is that of which I cannot say a single word or form a single concept. Now, why do I say that the eternal subsumes both timelessness and time? Time, all of us know. We know it as in two ways particularly. Chronological time, the good old clock, tick-tock time, and we also know time psychologically. When we are thoroughly happy in some sort of experience, time flies faster than the fastest aviator. And it is all over, and it comes to an end. When we are miserable, depressed, or anxious, or waiting for somebody who may or may not turn up, we find a few minutes of psychological time, of chronological time, feel like, as we say, an eternity. So that time we know. Now, we do experience timelessness in certain states when we are completely quiet within ourselves, or when we are completely concentrated, our attention is completely concentrated on some particular object of concentration, you see. So we become unaware of the passage of chronological time. We enter into a state of consciousness, a deep state of consciousness, and that lasts for a certain period, and then we have to wake up. Now, the Buddha himself, for instance, said time and again that he could stay 7 days and nights motionless in one posture, enjoying the bliss of the enlightened state. 7 days and nights at a stretch. You'll find it in black and white in the texts. But remember this. He has to come out of that state because the body is the body. It has to be fed, it has to eliminate, and it has to sleep in order that it may the vital energies of the body may be recharged and so forth. So that period of timelessness comes to an end in time. It starts in time. Say it starts on Sunday morning. It ends on Saturday, the next Saturday evening, we'll say. Something like that. You see? So that although it is timeless in the Buddha's experience, or if you can do it, in your experience, although it is timeless, it is not eternity. Eternity is something still other than that. Time and space all come into being with the Big Bang, not before that. Time, space, what we call matter, causality, everything comes into being after that. You see? Now, so much for time and timelessness. They are subsumed within the eternal. The eternal, eternity functions through both time and timelessness. I have often used this phrase, eternity rides on the wings of time. Eternity rides on the wings of time, just as immortality functions through mortality. Now you see, all these things represent modes of awareness, the manner in which you are actually conscious. And when you really experience something which resembles this sort of thing, well, then you know that the way in which the transcendent context has been presented has, on the whole, been mispresented. But that can't be helped. This is due to the fact that in the attempt to represent it, we have to use the language of mortality, of finitude, of temporality. We are compelled to use this language because all our language emerges out of the sphere of mortality, ruled by death's lord. Now, consider it this way too. Conceive of a point. Now, a child, if you tell a child, put down a point, he will take a pencil and just make a mark on a piece of paper, we'll say. That is not a point, that is a solid object. It has three dimensions, that is why you can see it, although you can't catch hold of it and move it out of the paper. You see? You can see it, it is visible, although it is not tangible. Now that is a point, but the true point which you can conceive of has no dimensions whatever. It has no length, no breadth, no depth. All three dimensions which we are ordinarily conscious of spatially, by virtue of our actual constitution, we are conscious that way. All three dimensions are absent where a point is concerned. It is purely conceptual. And by being purely conceptual, it is a reality, it is a real thing in mind, and it belongs to the realm of both the infinite and the finite. It is the infinity of the small. The point is the infinity of the small. The infinity of the large, well, that you can more easily sense. The point is like that, so that it is related to both contexts, the finite and the infinite. Now, if you can take countless points like that and put them side by side, would you make a line? You won't. Because there will be gaps between the points, side by side. You can't do it. You see? But if you take a point and move it, meaning thereby that the point comes to life, because life is movement, isn't it? The point comes to life, and what does it do? It produces a line. But what is a line? It is a finite length. One-dimensional. Its finitude expressed in one-dimensionality. And this comes out of the no-dimensionality of the point. Isn't it extraordinary? This has, I'm sure, a very deep relationship with the nature, the inner nature of consciousness, which ordinary psychologists can do not understand. But if you really can get quiet, and you've got your opportunities here, if you can get quiet and just let the brain settle down, not get active, stop talking in class, as the schoolmaster says, you see, and then something may happen to you. All right, so that's how you get your line. Now, the line, the pure line, is invisible still. It is both invisible and intangible. When you draw a line, it consists of a whole lot of solids. It's a solid thing. It is not purely one-dimensional. You can't take countless lines and produce a surface. There'll be gaps between the lines. But if that line comes to life and moves, makes a movement, it will produce a surface. The pure surface by itself is still invisible and intangible. The pure surface as such. But it is two-dimensional and it is finite. So you see, out of infinity, finitude has come into being by the self-restriction of infinity. This is the important point. By the self-restriction of infinity, finitude comes into being. Now, if a surface moves, then you'll get a solid object. You'll get a three-dimensional thing with length, breadth, and depth. And that is both visible and tangible. Now, the important point I want to put before you is this, that finitude, the whole of finitude, is due to the self-restriction of infinity. What makes infinity restrict itself? Well, the old texts, the Upanishads and so on, said that it was because the absolute all, Brahman, desired to know himself. In the Rig Veda, in that famous hymn, in the 10th book, the so-called creation hymn, number 10th book, hymn 129, there are ideas like this which are expressed, you see. All right. So now, we have talked of eternity, at least I have talked of eternity, and we have had a look at infinity and finitude. Then, as regards mortality and immortality. Now, how is it that we are conscious of mortality in the way in which we are conscious of mortality? Simply because we are discriminatively conscious in terms of particular objects, particular persons, particular trees, animals, stars, planets, whatever it is. You see, we are conscious three-dimensionally in space. We are endowed with that consciousness to start with. All human beings have a three-dimensional space consciousness. Now, when you look at a solid object, as we call it, you look at a mountain, you know how we talk of the eternal hills and the eternal stars. We use poetic expressions of that type. But they are not eternal as manifested objects. They are changing. Everything in the cosmos is continuously changing. Nothing does not undergo change. Now, supposing you can develop in such a way that you become aware of that change from split second to split second. Supposing you can do that. Where are you going to draw the line between one state of being and the new state of being? With us, when that which is visible to us, whether it be a person, an animal, or a solid object, when that is broken up or destroyed in some way, as we call it, we say, oh, that's dead. That person's dead, this animal's dead, this object is destroyed. That's the end of it, we say, you see. That is simply because our consciousness is so sluggish. It's so sluggish that we cannot follow the moment to moment, the split second change which takes place. But if you could become conscious of it that way, you are in tune with the pulse of creation itself all the time. And if you are in tune with the pulse of creation, then you will see that since all manifestation is perpetually changing, you are in tune without cessation, you are in, without stopping, you are in tune with the change process altogether. If you are continuously in tune with that change process, where do you draw the line and say this is birth and that is death? You can't. That is the actual experiencing of immortality. Immortality is experienced here and now in consciousness, in mind and consciousness. There is no other immortality, no other meaning to it, because then we'll muddle it up with time and mortality. Why do you think the Buddha said, opened for those who hear, who are willing to hear, are the doors of deathlessness? In the supreme meditative state, and this has been presented by the great mystics of the world, it is presented in the great religions of the world, through and through. In the supreme meditative state, you are in complete tune with the changing process of the universe as it changes. You are in the rhythm of your awareness is one with the rhythm of the changing process of the universe. And in that state, the deathlessness is realized. And in that, there is no ill whatsoever. So you see, we have these two contexts as such. And this transcendent context comes closer and closer to us as we live the pure life. This is fundamentally important. Because any sort of impurity spoils the mode of awareness, your mode of awareness of existence as such. So you can't desire immortality. You can't work for immortality. You can't say, oh, I will live like this, I will do this, that and the other, and I shall be immortal. You will never be immortal. You will never attain nirvana or the kingdom of heaven or anything. But the kingdom of heaven and nirvana and the immortal will function through you. You see, that's what will happen. It is not I who attain anything at all or achieve anything at all. How beautifully the Christian teaching puts it, for thine is the kingdom and the glory forever and ever. You see, that is the thing. As long as we try to live religiously simply because we want to achieve a certain goal for ourselves, we have defeated all our effort right from the start. We are doomed to failure that way. You remember yesterday I emphasized very strongly this business of homage. When we talked about homage, this complete and total self-surrender, the complete freedom from the shackles of selfness and the realization of the state of unselfness. And it is not you who realize it, it is transcendence itself which realizes through you. Transcendence comes to fulfillment as the perfect rose, as the perfect tree, as the perfect animal, as the perfect mosquito, as the perfect human. It is transcendence which comes to fulfillment in countless million different forms. Unto God the glory, in the real sense of the term. Now, if we begin to understand this, then, now you may call this metaphysics if you like, but if we begin to understand this and get the feel of it in our lives, we will find it much more easy to let life in its perfection and purity live through us. Our work is done by transcendence itself. It's a wonderful game that is played between transcendence and us. You see, I make the first move in this game. It is not transcendence which makes another move in response to it. But transcendence inspires me, because if my first move is right, to make the next move, which is the reply of transcendence actually. It's not mine. Now we can see the importance of the Buddha's statement of the unborn, the unbecome, the unmade. If there were not the unborn, unbecome, unmade, there'd be no release from this here that is the born, the become, the made. And I tried to explain this relationship of the two contexts, the finite, temporal and mortal, to the infinite, eternal and immortal, because it shows that the actuality, the ultimate reality, is a unitary whole. A unitary whole, which we, because of our vijnana, our discriminatory consciousness, we break it up into innumerable separate persons and bits and so on. You see, this is what Roman Catholicism really means by saying that we are born in sin. But I doubt whether Roman Catholic theology knows this. You see, we are born in sin. The fundamental meaning of the word sin is that which hurts or tends to spoil or break up the unity of the one total reality. It's a unitary whole. And the deepest states of consciousness which we are allowed by the grace of transcendence to realize is this state where that unitary wholeness completely takes us into itself. In Christian terms, it is said the manhood is taken up into the Godhead. Into the Godhead. Not into God, into the Godhead. The manhood is taken up into the Godhead. You take the name of Jesus, for instance, the Hebrew name, Yahshua. Yod, He, Shein, Vav, He. There is the letter Shein in between Yod, He, and Vav, He. Yod, He, and Vav, He is Yahweh. And the Shein is that which enfleshes the transcendent by self-constriction come into manifestation. That is its meaning. And that is perhaps the profoundest meaning of the incarnation, the doctrine of the incarnation. You see, there is really nothing to choose between the great religions. We choose to satisfy our particular idiosyncrasies, our particular temperament. We are satisfying ourselves by choice. But when one begins to see how we fool ourselves so much, then we stop exercising preferential choice. Preferential choice is one of our great enemies. We have to start with preferential choice, otherwise we might say, all right, my preferential choice is wine, women and song, nightclubs and whatnot. Let's have a good go whilst I'm alive. You see? It's like that. So we start with preferential choice. We must not imagine that we can live as if we were already perfected holy ones. And too many, I have lived long enough and been associated with so many various societies of very well-meaning people who are so deluded as to think that they have achieved this, that, or the other stage of perfection or excellence in the spiritual life and so forth. And they separate the spiritual life from the material everyday life, which is a profound error. It is here in the world that transcendence can realize itself as the perfect human through you or through me. Here and now in the world. But in order that that may happen, we have to be detached from being of the world. The worldliness has got to change into something divine. To use Shakespeare's wonderful phrase in The Tempest, when he talks, when Ariel talks about Ferdinand's father to Ferdinand, he says, "Full fathom five thy father lies," and so on. You know the lines. And of him nothing doth remain, but has changed into something rich and strange. The emphasis has to be on the strangeness, the unknown and the unknowable, so to say. You see? So now, because we function in terms of discriminative consciousness, we function in terms of the root avidya, avidya, ignorance, and avidya in Sanskrit, you see, is not seeing. That is our state of ignorance. It is not a question of lack of knowledge. It is the manner in which we are conscious, which is the state of ignorance. It's the ignorant state of consciousness. And we may see, therefore, that the necessity for affirmation of transcendence, the necessity for the affirmation of transcendence, because those affirmations show towards what we are developing. And it shows how, they show how we may grow towards being perfect humans. As I've already said, we don't achieve or attain. Transcendence does. And the result is that there is a complete transformation, a transmutation of our whole being and of our mode of awareness. So that the word I has lost completely, has become completely free of its false and sorrow-producing meaning which we gave it when we say I or you. The otherness has completely vanished. Try and feel it if you can, here and now. There is no otherness. There is this complete unity, a unitary wholeness. And if that consciousness of unitary wholeness comes to fruition, then there is the Mahakaruna, the perfect love, and the Mahaprajna, the perfect wisdom in operation, which is one of the hallmarks of the fruition of us as human beings. And the purpose of the Brahmacharya, as the Buddha used to say, has been fulfilled. Destroyed is jati. Don't translate jati as birth and rebirth. It is true that that is one of the meanings, but cut out that meaning. It's useless. Translate jati as the conditioned state. You are released out of the conditioned state, which is the state of dukkha, into the infinite, the eternal, and the immortal state. You see? Which is nirvana. Right. Now, we have a few minutes. Oh, yes, we have. Now, the question here is, in connection with homage, a total giving of self. The question is, what happens if the Lord is unworthy? Does one still obey such a person? The sort of natural tendency is to look for the guru, to try and find who is to be my teacher. Have I the qualifications to recognize that this person is my guru, my teacher? You know, the Buddha, in the Lohicha Sutta, it's one of the long discourses, in the Lohicha Sutta, points out who is the blameless teacher. And if you study that very carefully, you will see that the blameless teacher, in the Buddha's judgment and opinion, is the perfected Holy One himself. But have I the capacity to recognize the perfected Holy One? You know how it is. You have to be an expert jeweler yourself in order to correctly evaluate a gem which another person shows you. If you aren't a perfect jeweler, you can't do it. Isn't that so? Now, when I try to select a teacher, what do? I look for someone whom I like somehow. Oh, he seems all right. He's a clever fellow. He's a nice fellow. He's so kind. He's helpful. Yes, I'll have him. And I'm afraid so many marriages take place that way too. And then we know what happens afterwards. The mismarriage comes into being. So now, to give the whole of oneself will happen, giving the whole of oneself will happen naturally and spontaneously when the right people meet. You know the saying, when the disciple is ready, the teacher is there. We have to become ready. That lies within our power. The simple things, the living of the, what the Buddha called good conduct, the observance of the silas in thought and feeling, in word and in deed. You will find this emphasized way back in the original teachings in the Upanishads. A very good example is in the Shandilya Upanishad, one of the very little known Upanishads. The Shandilya Upanishads says outright that in thought and feeling, word and in deed, the person is truthful, honest, harmless, etc., 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 all the virtues are put out. Ten yamas are presented. You see? And in yoga too, the same thing happens. So we have that doesn't need an external teacher. Usually, though perhaps not in all cases, unfortunately, in the world, the parents instill some sort of morality in the child. And if we care for the real things, if we really care, then we will nurture, lovingly nurture that which is good. And in course of time, we will also, through our study and observation and so forth, we will come across the person who could be the teacher. You know how I have always disclaimed the word teacher applied to myself. I am not a teacher. What actually happens is this. If by listening or coming in contact with what I say or write, you find it helpful and you have learned something, your act of learning has, without my knowing it even, conferred teacherhood on me. Who am I to teach? Yesterday, you remember, I said there is no such thing as comparison in the sphere of reality, in the sphere of transcendence. There is no such thing as comparison. And today, I said, we are all, every one of us, literally, the children of the Divine, the Supreme. So who am I to claim to be a teacher? And I make many mistakes in the course of my talking. Do remember that, please. So when you ever put on the tapes which you may, or cassettes you may have of my talks and so on, do remember that I do make slips. Yes?
I agree entirely with you when the disciple was ready, the guru will appear. But the question that I put forward was more for somebody who is far, at the far lower sort of spiritual level. You start off by saying that the knights in the time of King Arthur paid homage to the king.
Mm.
So I was thinking more on that more materialistic level. As I mean, how much homage should one, if one's karma made one lowly slave, how much should one pay homage and obey a bad ruler? How much should a child obey a bad parent? You know, how much homage, how much giving of the self, and before reaching the state of,
yes,
of approaching a guru?
Yes, but now the word namo occurs in this invocation to the enlightened one, you see. And
yeah, but sir, I was thinking in everyday life,
one can't do that. One mustn't do that, in fact. One has to be self-responsible in society, in the real sense of the word, self-responsible, you see. And do remember this. There are no spiritual levels as such. Who is to measure? How do you measure? The Lord God doesn't have a super tape by which to measure the spiritual levels of all His children. You see, it's like that. No, in everyday life, it doesn't apply. The day of homage to the liege lord is over. That applied in the Middle Ages, in the days when knights and such people trod the earth. Now, here is another question. We are rightly told not to take life. How far down the line does this go? Many slaughter animals for food. We all eat plants, living things, and trees are cut down for wood and paper. Also, we are invaded by such things as viruses and worms. Well, as far as the viruses and worms are concerned, it is good sense to be free of them. If you take an antibiotic, it exterminates all the viruses. all the harmful viruses, doesn't it? That's what an antibiotic does. But what is the consequence of that? You, the human being, have probably escaped death. Not that there is any reason why I should escape death and continue to live. The universe will go on quite happily without me, just as it has done for 5,000 million years before I was born. But one has to be very sensible about these things. Use one's good sense in the matter. So, as far as viruses and worms are concerned, I think it is more sensible to take their life than to let them take a human life. Many slaughter animals for food. Now that is quite a sad situation. This wholesale slaughter of millions of animals. You see, such wholesale slaughter and our being accessories to the fact, because we eat the slaughtered animal, you see, we are accessories to the fact of slaughter. If we eat meat, now it desensitizes us, and the more desensitized we get, the less chance there is for living the religious life. You know, circumstance has much to say here. Supposing you are an Eskimo, you have no option but to live on meat. Supposing you lived in Tibet, in the cold parts of Tibet, very cold parts, high up and so forth, and when you can't possibly obtain vegetables and fruit, then in order that humans may live, they have to slay the animal and eat it. And in nature, as far as the animal kingdom itself is concerned, species live upon each other. You see, that is the fact of nature. But we can be free of that fact. Do remember that in India, it was only after the time of the Buddha that vegetarianism began to take a hold. Not before that. The Rig Vedic Aryans and the Dravidian inhabitants of India had a mixed diet. You have to decide for yourself what you'll do. Yeah. If one is really compassionate, don't be smarmingly sentimental about this business. Without sentimentality, if there is real compassionateness, then you will probably want to abstain from participating, from being responsible for the slaughter of animals. And animals are such good animals, including the beasts of prey, as we call them. They live according to the law of their being, which very few humans do. Now, we all eat plants which are living. Yes, we do. But you have to eat something in order to be alive. And there are so many elements of the plant kingdom which do not necessitate killing. Grain, for instance, all grain. You don't kill anything, you know, do you? When you harvest the crop, you don't kill anything. And fruit, that fruit will fall off the tree in any case if you don't pluck it. And by plucking fruit from a tree, you don't kill the tree. The same with nuts and so on. Think it out carefully and be very, very sensible in the process of your thinking. Don't let unnecessary sentimentality make you do certain things, or indifference to the suffering in the animal world. And trees are cut down for wood and paper. Yes. Again, the circumstance has a very powerful influence. What can we do about it? I feel very unhappy whenever I see a tree being cut down. And to hear the sound of that great tree falling down like that, helplessly, because a human being has cut it off like that. It's terrible, really. But there we are. What can we do? Our life is such, our circumstance is such. We must do what is possible. That is being politic, the art of the possible. But let all your idealism and so forth have its full say insofar as it doesn't go beyond the bounds of good sense. You have to exercise good sense all along the line. That's all I can say about it.